You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Haiti recently made a brief reappearance in the Canadian media. This was to mark 2 years since the earthquake devastated homes and buildings, killing hundreds of thousands of Haitian people. Then, as is their habit, the media moved on. Our guest, Kim Ives, has been focused on Haiti before, during, and since the earthquake. He is the editor of the weekly newspaper Haiti Liberté, which he founded 5 years ago. It has offices in Haiti and in New York. Before that, he wrote and photographed for 23 years for the weekly Haiti Progrès. Currently, Kim Ives is on a speaking tour in the Vancouver area, and we've reached him by phone this morning in Victoria. Hello, Kim.
Hello.
How would you describe the current situation in Haiti 2 years after the earthquake?
I think it's very grave. The neo-Duvalierist sector, which was driven from power in 1990, 20 years ago, with the election of former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, has returned to power in large part because of popular dissatisfaction with the government of former President René Préval. And I think a lot of that frustration is misplaced because of the sabotage, I could say, of the international community, of the recovery efforts. In short, much of the money, about $5 billion, has not gone to the Haitian people, but has really been intercepted by the NGO and contractor intermediaries. And this has created a situation of great difficulty.
Is the present political regime, in your view, stable?
Not really. We are in Haiti, as a Haiti Liberté, have been following a brewing crisis around the passport of President Michel Martelly, who appears may well be a U.S. citizen, in which case he will, in fact, have fraudulently become president. The Haitian constitutional explicitly forbids anybody with dual nationality from holding the presidency or running for the presidency. Should this come to light, and right now there is a Senate commission investigating the matter, it will create a political crisis and could go either way. The parliament will surely move to impeach Martelly, but Martelly himself, who I think has expressed authoritarian wishes in the past, may well try to dissolve the parliament. So I think the situation is very dodgy.
What level of rebuilding has there been if we were to walk around areas of Haiti that were damaged by the earthquake? What do they look like now?
Well, it's very unfinished. There, you'll see a lot of evidence 2 years later of the earthquake, rubble, piles of rubble. There were a number of public buildings which were cleared by the Préval government, and there is a continuing effort to clear many of the IDP, internally displaced people's camps. But they still exist. There are about 500,000 people still living in about 800 camps spread around the country. There is a continuing crisis in those camps of no water, no electricity, no services, which had at one point been brought to them. Part of the way they're forcing them out, in addition to police raids and sometimes just hired goons, is to pinch off the services to these camps. So people are suffering in them, and many people have had to leave them and move back into houses which are marked either red or yellow by the Ministry of Public Works, which means they either should be torn down in the red case or repaired in the yellow case. But tens of thousands of people have moved back into these unsafe buildings because the camps are being closed.
Now, last year, you wrote a series of articles based on WikiLeaks revelations of secret U.S. government cables dealing with Haiti. How did you obtain access to these cables?
Well, we got in touch, or I should say WikiLeaks got in touch with us. As your listeners may know, WikiLeaks first released the 250,000 confidential State Department cables they received to large mainstream media, the New York Times, The Guardian in England, Der Spiegel in France, and Le Monde, Der Spiegel in Germany, and Le Monde in France. And those papers did very little with the documents. They published only a fraction. And even then, for instance, in the case of the New York Times, they went to great lengths to trumpet the fact that they had cleared with the State Department the stories that they wrote about it. So it was far from aggressive use of those documents. So WikiLeaks then said, we're going to turn to the nations affected by those stories, and they sent teams to countries around the world, including Haiti, and they would select a viable partner in the country, and in the case of Haiti, they selected Haiti Liberté. And so they delivered to us 1,918 documents, which were all those tagged Haiti. That doesn't mean they necessarily came from the Port-au-Prince embassy, but they might have been from the Vatican post or from Paris or from someplace in Latin America, but they were all tagged Haiti, had to deal with Haiti. And so that is how we came into possession of the documents.
Well, that's a tremendous amount of documents, and there must have been a lot of information in there. What are some of the main points that you found out?
Well, principally, we learned of information really about beginning a year after the coup. We knew the documents began in 2003, and we were sort of rubbing our hands together in anticipation before receiving them that we would finally learn the role of the U.S. in the February 29, 2004 coup against President Aristide. But unfortunately, none of the documents did not contain cables relative to that, except a few in 2003 out of the Bahamas and one or two out of Europe and the Vatican. But the majority of them began in March 2005 and really looked at the post-coup regime that the U.S. installed, the La Tortue regime, and that of the one that followed it, that of former President René Préval. And there we essentially looked at the stories of the sabotage that they undertook against the Préval government, who was in some ways a sometime ally, sometime irritant to them. In particular, we began with the case of the Petro-Caribe arrangements. The Préval government had dealings not just with Washington, but also with Cuba and Venezuela, which Washington viewed those relationships with a great deal of anger. And we saw that in the Petro-Caribe arrangements. Petro-Caribe is a deal whereby Venezuela provides a nation, in this case Haiti, with 60% of its oil needs, or 100% of its oil needs, but only 60% are paid up front, and 40% are paid over the course of 25 years at 1% interest. This saves the country $100 million, which the embassy itself recognized was in the advantage of Haiti, but they fought tooth and nail on behalf of the two big U.S. oil giants, Texaco Chevron and ExxonMobil, to torpedo that agreement. And really through 2 years of back and forth between 2006 to 2008, the embassy dueled with the Préval government until finally the Préval government managed to get the deal through and implemented in Haiti. So we really were able to see all the contours and the back and forth and the scheming and the arrangements and dealings that happened between the oil companies and the embassy and how these U.S. interests were really defended by the embassy. So it was really almost a case study. That was really our opening piece with the cables. But we also saw how Canada, the U.S., France, and the European Union worked to, help sabotage the elections that eventually took place in 2010, the November 2010 elections that saw the election of President Martelly, by essentially signing off on the exclusion of the Lavalas Family Party. In fact, the Canadian ambassador at the secret meeting of those ambassadors said that this would be folly, that the Haitian people would not vote in such an election and would rise up against it. And indeed, only 25% of the Haitian electorate went out to that election because of their consternation at the exclusion of the Lavalas family, the party of former President Aristide. So we saw that. We also saw how they fought and worked together to fight against the return of President Aristide in March 2011, how they conspired not just to block him in South Africa where he was in exile, but how they worked to block him en route by perhaps tying him up in a country where his plane would have to refuel. So this was in addition to many articles which really revealed the corruption and brutality, repression of sectors in the Haitian bourgeoisie who were working within the coup government of 2004 to 2006. We did an expose of Yuri Latortue, one of the biggest and most powerful Haitian politicians, a close ally of President Michel Martelly now. This was a real, I could say, bomb in the middle of the political scene, which in fact put the bourgeois sources for the embassy, in particular a businessman called Fritz Miz, on the defensive, to the point where, in response to the Haiti Liberté piece, he wrote a very long letter of apology to Yuri Latortue, saying he was out of his mind when he was speaking to the embassy. So it was had a lot of political impact in Haiti, and I think we hope beyond the 14 articles that we wrote over the summer to go back through them and see if we can glean a little more information.
Now, John Bertrand Aristide managed to return from forced exile despite the interference that was being run against him. What is his situation presently, and what is the state of activity of his political party, Famille Lavalas?
Well, that's the very interesting thing, is that you have Jean-Claude Duvalier, who returned to Haiti in January 2011. He was technically, nominally, placed under house arrest, is being investigated by an investigating judge on charges of embezzling close to $1 billion. This is very well documented. And also for his crimes against humanity, essentially torture, imprisonment, unconstitutional imprisonment, disappearances, and executions carried out during his 15-year reign from 1971 to 1986. But Jean-Claude Duvalier is able to be seen on almost any night of the week at expensive Pétionville restaurants, dining. He's been traveling around the country, basically thumbing his nose at this house arrest order. And meanwhile, President Aristide, who came back to the acclaim of tens of thousands of people who poured out spontaneously into the streets, basically carried him on a human wave back to his home, he has not been able to leave that home in Tabar since his arrival there in March 2010, 2 days before the election. This is the irony, he's in fact under de facto house arrest, while Jean-Claude Duvalier is not. So this really speaks to the political situation. And that has meant that his party has a tremendous amount of traction. They are holding assemblies in the various departments. Those are like provinces in Canada. There are 10 departments in Haiti, and they're holding meetings in preparation for a national congress that they look to hold in March. I doubt it will actually be held in March. I imagine it'll be later, probably May or June, and at which point they hope to elect a new leadership to the party, and Aristide will step back to become more of a Mandela-like figure who will act as some sort of symbol and sage, but will not be involved in the day-to-day runnings of the party.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us this morning, Kim. It's been really interesting, and I'm going to let people know about the public meetings that are coming up so that they can go and hear you talking on a variety of different topics around Haiti.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Kim Ives. He is founder and editor of the weekly newspaper Haiti Liberté, which he founded 5 years ago.